Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to get started with panel number 2453. Welcome to the Conference on World Affairs, Boulder, Colorado, 2017. The title of panel episode 2453 is China, Our Banker, Trade Partner, and Threat. So, a couple of things about the app. I think many of you are familiar with it so far. This session, we are using both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. If you need a question or if you need a note card, put your hand up towards the end and I will you will be directed to one of the producers. Kaylee, would you put your hand up? There's one producer and there's another producer, but they're straight in the back of the room. They will grab your cards. And if you if you're a student, we will give you priority if we can. And there is also the app. I will be fielding questions from the app as the questions come in. Okay, so as I introduce the panel, we have, you may notice, one missing, and that's Lawrence Brom. He is on his way from another panel. Neil, at the end here, just flew into DIA at about 10 o'clock this morning. So he literally just walked in. So we're going to let him go last, give him a breather a little bit here. Okay. My first panelist, Mr. Larry Greenwood, to my immediate left, is the current president of the Japanese Society for Northern California. Larry has an extensive background in banking throughout Asia and the Asian Development Bank, ADB. He spent 4 years in Tokyo managing government relations through MetLife and 5 years in Manila, the Philippines, working as co-leader of the Asian Development Bank. Career diplomat, he's spent time at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, postings in Philippines and the Singapore. Needless to say, Larry is an absolute expert on the subject of Asia and China and banking especially. Note the title is something about banking, so we have possibly the most authoritative banking expert in the region with us. All of these panelists, by the way, have incredible backgrounds, and I know that we'll get Lawrence in here too, but we have some very impressive panelists. So the ADB that Larry has worked with has literally helped make the Asian economy one of the most healthy in the world. He's worked 20, 30 years and working with many billions of dollars in investment, a lot of infrastructure, and that means big stuff, really big stuff. Next we have Peter Light, and Peter was a founding chairman of JP Morgan Bank in China. Again, where can you find bigger experts than these?
Easy.
He's worked in London, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. He's a founding representative of Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company in Beijing. Teaches Asian history. He also has, actually all of these panelists have books that are out right now. I'm going to do a shameless plug. I know this is not a commercial enterprise, but I would like to help all of these wonderful speakers sell their books. And some people don't know that the books are available at Mackey Auditorium. Just walk over there. Every speaker has their books. And I love books. Students love books. Everybody loves books. I would suggest reading some of the books here. Peter's, one of the foundations that he works with is called OneSky.com. It's a charity that helps work with the villages of China. As you know, there's kind of two Chinas. There's the coastal rural China, and then there's coastal China, the cities, and then there's the inner circles of China, and there's quite a bit to be done as far as help, and he works in those areas there. And next we have Neil Diamant, who is a, he focuses on law and society in Asia. He's a professor of Asian law and culture, and also an author of many books, which can be found at the Mackey Auditorium. He speaks of patriotism and comparative perspective. He's a pretty much of an expert on the history of Chinese constitutionalism. That's a mouthful. But this is how This is an analysis of how laws are implemented and interpreted throughout the country. So again, there may not be a bigger expert in that sect of Asian knowledge that we have here. And lastly, thank you, Lawrence.
A drum roll. Hey.
Lawrence Brohm, I am pleased to meet. Has an incredible background, a multilingual dialogue on climate change and community resilience. Lawrence has worked with panels forming policy responses to anthropogenic climate-induced glacial melt. He's worked as an advisor to Chinese Ministry of Environmental Protection. He's worked with an advisor to Bhutan's National Environmental Commission. He's contributed to 2 decades of economic reform in China. He's also, if that's not enough, he's led 3 expeditions searching for the mythical kingdom of Shangri-La. And he has produced 3 books that are also available for sale at the Mackey Auditorium. And I'll leave it with something about, I read a little bit about the search for Shangri-La, and it is the way to find Shangri-La is to seek, I have to read this, seek access and traverse parallel universes through the digital code embedded in the secret mantra. That's what we've got
so
here
today. So we're done.
That's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I think what we'll do is just start with Larry first and run down the line. And then afterwards we'll take questions from the audience. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for managing expectations well. And we're in for real trouble now. I'm just a simple trade and finance guy, so I don't know. The person that Tom was talking about is must be someplace else. I thought I'd just go a little bit over the how China has become our banker and trade partner, is in the title. And I forgive me for those of you who know this story, because it's actually a very familiar story. Unfortunately, it's not the one that was told over the last year and a half in the elections, but it's the real story about how we got where we are. And it also helps because in terms of how we can go forward, it matters, you know, how we got to where we are in the first place. The main reason is, and both the financial and the trade balances actually are the different sides of the same coin. And those imbalances arose mainly for macroeconomic reasons, and that is because on the Chinese side, China had this explosion of growth driven by policies that promoted exports and also policies that promoted investment in China, particularly in infrastructure, but also in industry, and a suppression of consumption in China. And also encouragement of savings. And so they encouraged savings, they encouraged investment, they encouraged exports, they suppressed consumption. And when you do that, macroeconomically, you run trade surpluses and you get lots of financial resources coming to you. On the U.S. side, we, as you all know better than me, we adore consumption. So we consume a lot. We don't save as much. That means we are going to be running a current account deficit, which we do to the world. And because we do consume a lot, and China came onto the scene, particularly after WTO accession, we have a very large bilateral imbalance. But macroeconomically, we run a overall imbalance as well. And it also means that for our, and then we had a capital outflow. So China is sitting on a lot of reserves, much of that in the form of U.S. Treasury bills. It was a very large amount, more than they needed. That's where we are. Now, the good news is that China realized about 10 years ago that their export investment-driven growth model was not sustainable, that it was breaking down. And they've had, for the last at least 3 5-year plans, they've actually identified that as a critical issue for China's growth and for their economy, and also have been trying to put in various regulations and policies to take care of that, increasing interest rates, paying savers more money, getting rid of some trade barriers and trying to reduce the investments, particularly in infrastructure, or reduce the speed of the speed of the increase. The problem that they've had, though, is that it's very difficult to do, and it's difficult to do politically because there's lots of vested political interests in the old system. The people who run the state-owned enterprises aren't interested in breaking up state-owned enterprises. The PLA, the military, which runs a lot of companies, are not interested in having those companies become private companies and run on a private basis. The local government leaders are not interested in having a less investment because that's how they grow their provinces and it reduces the amount of corruption that they can undertake to get money for themselves. So there's lots of vested interests against that change within China, and there's a battle that's been going on for those 10, 15 years between the pro-reform faction and the kind of resistance to that those changes. And that battle continues to this day. But there has been some change, and so you have seen obviously a slowdown in the increase of exports. You've seen a very fast actually sell-off of their reserves, and so they've had a tremendous amount of reserves that have been sold in the last year and a half, 2 years. And that's because, in fact, I should have added that the other thing that the other policy that they've done in order to keep export competitive was intervene in the currency market, buy dollars, sell the RMB, and that's in order to keep the RMB low so it could be continue to be competitive. That has reversed because now they're worried actually about the RMB becoming too low. They're now concerned about capital outflow from China. And so it's exactly the opposite. So they're actually intervening now tremendously in order to keep the yuan from going lower, and that means that they're spending their reserves. In the last couple of months, it's actually reversed a little bit, but basically the trend is still that those foreign reserves are going down. So that's a good sign. It shows that these financial imbalances are at least beginning to come back in line, but they've got a long, long way to go before those imbalances go away. And I tell the story because we both, the U.S. and China, actually have an interest in taking care of this, of the financial and trade imbalance. I mean, this is not good for their growth model, and it's definitely not good for us, both economically and, of course, as we've seen, politically. So that takes us to where we are today. We had a pretty good bilateral last week between President Trump and President Xi. And on the economic side, a continuation of a lot of the policies of the last administration. Now, this is not obviously the way that the president ran. That was not his rhetoric in the campaign. But in my view, the most dangerous thing in the world is for a politician to fulfill his campaign promises. And that's particularly the case with this president. But it's true of all politicians. And so I'm actually not at all disturbed and very frankly gratified that it looks like that there's, at least so far, they're proceeding in very much the same way. They're calling it the comprehensive partnership. You may have heard that, the U.S.-China comprehensive dialogue, sorry. And it's going to deal with the issues that were very much the same as that was dealt in the last administration's China initiative, which was called the U.S.-China strategy and economic, what was it called again? Economic and strategy dialogue. Thing. Strategy and economic and strategic dialogue. And it's security, economic, law enforcement / cybersecurity, and culture. And those are the four baskets for the new comprehensive dialogue. That sounds great. It deals with the whole thing. The only kind of interesting card in the deck, that the joker in the deck that's not quite clear yet, is this announcement that they're going to have a 100-day program to address to take care of the imbalances, not even address. That strikes me as fanciful, but we'll see what kind of comes out of that. And that still obviously raises a lot of more questions than it answers, and there wasn't any answers to what that exactly means. Let me just stop there and listen to the others.
For those I didn't greet this morning, I'd like to wish you a happy Passover. Sometimes I think that my three decades abroad in banking was a diversion from my appointed rounds, which was studying the classics. I'm a devotee of the Chinese classics, And I'd like to share one item with you that I learned, which was probably the most important thing I learned about China in the course of my entire life. China is the only civilization of significance that has no creation myth. So I asked, just let that settle in, okay? And I think if you, and I think about, I guess I'm a real sad git because I think about this a lot. And I think that phenomena is regarded very differently in a world that is seen thusly, much more as a net than as a string. So when Larry was talking about entanglements, I think that was a perfect segue into some of the remarks I would like to make. Sorry for boring some of you who heard me this morning, but I think that it's worth repeating that there's no country in the world that has a greater interest in the success of America than China. They are giving us all of their money. Most of the time when people give you their money, you are grateful for it. We have decided to put some unfortunate expression on this decision to invest as something sinister, dare I say racist, smacking of the yellow peril. This is just rubbish. We have to see the Chinese as people who want us to succeed. I think it's really very important. I think the primary difference between our relationship with Russia and China is that the Russians are neither a world economic power nor a major trading partner of America. That is deeply significant. Mm-hmm. Basically, this sounds really odd, but who cares about Russia? It's a really odd thing. I mean, Putin scares me to death, but the significance is not the kind of significance that is appropriate. And I think we should pay more attention to the Chinese who we insist upon fearing and fear the man who we insist upon worshiping these days. Okay, I had my say. I'm done. So I would suggest that the complexity of our relationship with China, I think, will provide a context of engagement which will preserve our relationship. The Sino-American relationship is critical to our world, and I think it provides safety in world affairs. So the closer we get to China, the more enmeshed we are in China, the tighter the net gets with the Chinese, the better off we are. And I think any moves to undermine trade by the new administration with China will add to the danger of the world. I mean, what happened to the Republicans who like trade? You know, the world has been turned on its head. There is one wild card, and I would urge you to pay attention to this, although it's not sexy to talk about, and that is Taiwan. Study China a long time. I'm into the smoke and mirrors and all this kind of stuff, but I also know the importance of smoke and mirrors. The one China policy, which basically says either China owns Taiwan or Taiwan owns China, who cares, has allowed both Taiwan and China and America to thrive. Why would we tamper with something that we really don't understand? I think it's very important to grasp the import of Taiwan. Taiwan, from the mainland's point of view, belongs to China. This is not a debatable matter. And furthermore, we have a defense treaty with Taiwan. So the last thing we want to do is end up in a war with China through Taiwan by supporting a system that would undermine our own best interests. So I was very pleased, as Larry was saying, that the campaign rhetoric gave rise to good sense when the president abandoned the challenge to the Taiwanese independence movement. It would be a grave mistake. So I thank you. That's enough for me.
So this is my first time here, not in Boulder, but at this conference. Maybe by a show of hands, can I get a sense of where you guys stand on this question of, is China a threat? So by a show of hands, how many of you think that China is an economic threat? Raise your hand. Okay. How many of you think China is a strategic threat? Okay, a bit more. How about, is China a cultural threat? Not a single hand goes up. That's interesting. I want to start with something that's just one line on the bio that you have of me currently. Because I teach at Dickinson is in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which is also where the U.S. Army War College is located. And once in a while, they invite people from academia to teach over there at the War College. And most of the students are lieutenant colonels and colonels who may or may not be promoted to general at some point in their careers. And their perspective was mainly, you know, China is a threat. We have to prepare for it. We have all these maneuvers. We have all these war games preparing for the eventual threat from China. And, you know, I come in from a liberal arts college, and we're sort of taught to think a little bit more eclectically about countries. And I made the case over and over that China is, I think, not particularly threatening to us for a bunch of different reasons. First of all, there's a well-known book called War in Human Civilization by a military historian named Azar Gatt, teaches in Israel. And one of the things he finds is that, generally speaking, wealthy countries don't go to war with one another, in large part because there's very little to gain from it. There's a lot to lose and very little to gain. China is wealthy enough now that it stands to lose a great deal in any minor or major conflagration with the United States. So in other words, it wouldn't be in their interest. Second of all, China has many students here. We send students to China. Many people are studying Chinese. Chinese study English, of course. There's a lot of exchange of ideas between our countries. I don't think people return from China thinking China is our enemy, you know, let's go attack it. Among the younger generation, I don't get a sense of China as a source of major antagonism. I also pointed out that China as an economic power is very vulnerable to the United States, particularly because of its dependence on oil from the Middle East. We have the most powerful blue sea navy in the world. It is very easy for the United States to cut off choke points, various choke points, and China's supply in oil. I mean, China might change this in the future, but in the meantime, China is quite vulnerable. And so my general point was that both of our countries really don't have an interest in any sort of escalation. Now, the basis of this, of course, was that we are both rational actors, that China is a rational actor and the United States is a rational actor, and we'll act according to the principles of rationality. So I published a piece on this with the Strategic Studies Institute at the War College, and I get a call from a reporter from Xinhua News Agency, and he says, "Thank you. You find you understand China. You're not like all these American politicians who, you know, on the hustings are always shouting about how China is a threat and we need to be careful what we do with China, and so forth." I have to say that I'm less certain about that argument these days, in part because I'm not sure we can presume the same level of rationality, both on China's part and on our part, I think particularly our part. One thing we know that governments do is, when they have all sorts of domestic problems, is try to distract attention from those domestic problems by creating crises when, objectively speaking, there's no real crisis that is there. So the South China Sea, for example, problems there can be resolved diplomatically. Is there an interest to resolve them diplomatically? Who's to say? It could be just in those leaders' interest to foment a little crisis, to get people aroused, get people excited about a possible conflict, and then sort of turn it down when people are sufficiently distracted. I think that can happen here, and I think it can happen in China too. So, from the Chinese perspective, We know that there's been an ongoing anti-corruption campaign. It used to be the case in anti-corruption campaigns in China that people would emerge with the impression that the central government is basically clean and it's the little guys, the low-level officials who are corrupt. However, Xi Jinping has made it a point to emphasize that this campaign is not only about little guys but also big tigers, and not a few have been caught. And the result of this has been a decline in the legitimacy of the central government, which could lead at some future point to an effort to bolster the legitimacy of the regime by creating a crisis when, objectively speaking, a crisis doesn't have to exist. China has all sorts of other problems. Relatively high level of unemployment among university graduates. It has a very high level of inequality, certainly higher than the United States at this point. There are many elites in China who feel discomfort with the increased authoritarian tendencies of Xi Jinping, his sort of a Maoist political style. We know the population has very little faith in Marxism and Maoism. What is the glue that is holding the Chinese population together now? It's not exactly clear. So from a domestic perspective, it can be seen at some point in the interest of the government to create a crisis, create a sense of threat, a sort of rally around the flag effect that could affect its behavior at different crisis points. So I think there's a little bit more uncertainty now than there was several years ago. I think there's more room for mistakes, for unintentional problems. This happens all the time in world politics. Problems are created that are, in hindsight, were completely unnecessary. Now, on the U.S. side, we know that our president is deeply disturbed by having lost the popular vote. He himself feels that he doesn't have the same level of legitimacy that he would have had he won the popular vote. We know that he likes creating splashy media events. Crises are good for that. So both from the U.S. perspective and the China's perspective, I think there's a higher likelihood now of some mistake resulting from various scenarios deliberately created by both regimes. I can't believe I'm referring to the U.S. as a regime. I usually don't do that. But we always say, they have regimes. We have administrations. Right? But to use the same terminology, I think both regimes do have more incentive in creating a crisis now than they had in the past. And I think that is worrisome. So to add to other people's comments here, I think there's more in the brew now. There's more in the mix than there used to be. And I think that is a cause for concern. Thank you.
I recognize some familiar faces from this morning. So you may remember that I like to say counterintuitive things. So I'm going to say a lot of counterintuitive things. In 1996, I wrote a book called China as Number One. It was keying off of the book that Ezra Vogel had written, I guess, in the early 80s called Japan as Number One. And I was basically proposing that China would become the number one economic superpower within the century. That book got me labeled by a lot of people as a communist, a panda hugger, was severely rejected in my own country. But what I was really doing was mapping out exactly what were the plans of the government for its transition from planning to market and where they would go next, and chapter by chapter, looking at this from currency to trade and projecting ahead. And it wasn't really guesswork. It was based on my access to the administration and to the leadership, because I was working and advising on state-owned enterprise reform and a number of other financial reforms, so I knew what they were thinking. And then in 2001, I wrote another book. There was a book that came out called The Coming Collapse of China by Gordon Chang, another lawyer, which predicted that China would definitely collapse within 5 years because it's not a democracy. That was written around 2000. And I... I wrote a book called China's Century, and it really came out with the view that the 19th century, Britain dominated, the 20th century was America's century, and the 21st century would be China's. And again, I was labeled a panda hugger and communist and all those things. But really looking at China's, again, market projections forward. Then in 2009, I was speaking at the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington, and I wrote a piece for their Pacific Network publication talking about the rise or the internationalization of the yuan currency and the fact that China was not getting anywhere with its purchases of SDRs at the IMF, the World Bank, and it was not getting the influence it wanted. And consequently, it was going to evolve the renminbi currency into the next reserve currency. And people thought I was stark raving crazy. They didn't even want me to speak at CSIS. I'm making those predictions because you can kind of see where they're going, and I'm going to make a few more predictions. China, within the next 5 years, will be the global leader in green energy. It will lead the world in this. It will export new systems of green energy, including water systems, throughout the developing world and probably to the developed world as well. And I'll talk about that in more detail. Second, they will lead the world on robotics and artificial intelligence. That may come as a shock to you. But that industry is huge right now, particularly in the South, and they're turning their cheap toy industry into a robotic industry. I'm very close to people who are leaders in that industry. There will be very soon Einstein robots that are this big that can go into Chinese households and teach physics, mathematics, and quantum physics to children in Chinese. You get your own private tutor. That's all stuff that is happening. It's not an idea. And they will also develop an entirely alternate framework to Bretton Woods, to the system that we know, that we have relied on. And the yuan currency will evolve into the second reserve currency. And that will change the whole game of international politics. So I'll talk about two of those predictions in detail. One is the environmental one, and the second is the evolution of the alternate Bretton Woods. And the environmental one is something that, at a policy level, has already happened. And so I'll give you a little background of this. I'm not always pro-China. I had a lot of disagreements with the administration of former Premier Wen Jiabao. The $3 trillion stimulus package that went into a lot of redundant industries, the excess mining that took place, the double-digit growth rates were things that I did not agree with as policy. And China enjoyed double-digit growth. During those years, the official position of that administration, Wen Jiabao's administration stepped down around, 2013. Okay, so the view then was that we need to have high growth rates in order to maintain social political stability and make people happy and keep them employed. Therefore, the environment will be the cost of that. Too bad. We have to kill the environment in order to have high growth. That was the official position. And I strongly disagree with them. There were a number of people who did. The outcome of that, and just to put it in perspective, when Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao came into power, there was an average of about official statistics, 80,000 riots a year in China. People don't know about this. By the time they were stepping down from power, that number was about 150,000. Most of them based on, well, corruption is one issue, but the other is environment, normally connected to corruption, pollution of streams, pollution of rivers, whole towns and cities and people being, you know, ill and even getting cancer because of toxic in the water. Some 60 to 70, it depends on which numbers you're looking at, but some 60 to 70% of the water systems in China are polluted. add that to agriculture, it affects food security, health security. So now, what do you do about this? So as there was a transition, and the former administration of Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao were stepping down, a new administration was coming in, the current one of Xi Jinping, who is the president, and Li Keqiang, who is the premier, or equivalent of prime minister. And as it was coming in, I was working with a number of the people I had worked with in the previous administration on drafting ideas about how to rethink growth and the environment and to use some of the combination of planning and market, which China has really, in a way, created its own system, which doesn't care whether it's planning or market as long as it gets the job done, in terms of looking at the environment as the next driver for growth, in a new kind of growth. And to make a long story short, that ended up getting a lot of support from the incoming administration. So now my team with Himalayan Consensus were on leading a very big working team, huge team in fact, of people who were drafting what would become the policy of ecological civilization adopted by the Central Committee, that's the party, and the State Council, the government, on April 25th, 2015. We had five drafts, and those five drafts were effectively bulged together in one big document. To make it short, there's five very simple principles, or core principles. Infrastructure investment must be not in the old stuff, polluting industries like cement and steel. It's got to also be in now renewable energy. 70% of China's energy needs have been supplied by coal. Coal's enemy number one. You've got to wipe out coal. That means you've got to address certain conditions in three or four key provinces, Shanxi, Ningxia, Inner Mongolia, and Gansu province, which are providers of coal, which means you've got to create new industries. You've got to create new sources of income, or the government has to step in and pay. Creating entirely new systems of cities that are, we call, smart, green, and blue, meaning you've got smart public infrastructure, you've got water recycling systems, you're looking at buildings that are producing their own energy, systems of finance to drive this forward, the rethinking of growth, actually looking at growth as not the old industrial output, but looking at it in terms of what's a healthy economy. Rebalancing it, we call it GDP plus, plus healthcare, plus social welfare, plus environmental conditions, or social well-being environment. And then education, massive investment into the next generation. In my personal view, student debt is a violation of human rights. And we should, our greatest asset, and I've said this to Chinese leadership, your greatest asset is your students. It's not a debt. And you want to invest in that asset. And of course, all the technology, every single thing that we have in this room can be powered by renewable energy. And the technology is already there. So now you have to raise capacity, but that affects everything. It affects finance, it affects law, it affects whatever you think of, whatever industry it is, there has to be a rethink of that, and you have to invest in the students, as well as a change in values. The values in China were to get rich is glorious, and I have stood in front of the government, and I have said, Deng Xiaoping said, to get rich is glorious. That is old-fashioned. To protect the environment is glorious, not to get rich. And that might sound shocking, but I have stood up in front of leadership and said that. And that has gone into the policy, not those exact words, but actually rethinking values at the local level. So now you have propaganda, save water, don't lose water, all kinds of things, turn the lights out. I mean, it goes down to the very common, what we call populist propaganda, to teach people basic rethinks of values. So this is where we're going with the environment. A couple of thoughts, because you always hear about the pollution in Beijing. We have terrible pollution, but it's changed a bit. Within 1 year, 25,000 factories were shut down. Those factories have antiquated energy systems. They have to be redone. So we do have black skies in Beijing, usually in January, February, December, those 3 months, because that's when the coal heat is turned on through the official systems. But now in the springtime, summer and fall, you have much better weather. You have blue skies again. Okay, so there's a rethink. The capital of Beijing, as the capital, is being rebuilt. It's being moved out of Beijing. Within the next few years, it will move out to Hebei province and it will become an ecological smart city. So there's massive changes that are going on right now. Now, how does that then expand to the rest of the world? One of the things we've argued is that China's greatest soft power will be the export of environmental technologies. One thing I'll put in perspective. A lot of my work with the environmental ministry was funded by the European Union. Do you know why? All the technology for renewable energies in Europe, they have everything, okay? It's quite sophisticated today. And one of the differences between Paris, COP21 being successful and Denmark not being successful is the technologies leapfrog with only a few years. Okay? Europe has the technology. So let me use an example. In Finland, there are tech companies called Tekes, in fact. It's a state-run technology think tank that works with Finnish businesses. They have houses that produce their own electricity. Okay? They do it through geothermal, they do it through sun, they do it through... And the houses can sell to other houses. Now, Finland has a population, the whole country, of 4 million people. That is not even the size of a sub-district in any major Chinese city. How many people do you have in Boulder? 100,000. The smallest neighborhood committee in Beijing is bigger than that. The smallest unit of administration. So, I mean, you think about now taking technology from Boulder or technology from Finland and bringing it to China and raising the capacity level. It's huge. And the cost will drop massively. Okay? Other thing we were involved with is China issued the first green bond was done by Swedish, Scandinavian, Escanon Banken with China together. China today is the largest issuer of green bonds in the world. Over 50% of all green bonds are issued by China. That has to go into green and smart infrastructure. There's conditions. If you're raising money through a bond for a city, you have to use it for smart, green, blue infrastructure. Okay, so now how does this now move into the globalization of the yuan currency? Okay, China has a policy. Do I have 3 more minutes?
Yep.
China has a policy of One Belt, One Road. You may have heard of this. This is a very convoluted way of saying the New Silk Road. And effectively what they're doing is they're saying, look, how do we get out of underdevelopment? One of the key things was infrastructure. A lot of China's factories were in the interior. In the early stages was to put roads in, ports in, create infrastructure. Okay, infrastructure creates jobs, it creates connectivity. Now, what do you need? You need infrastructure. My colleague was talking about energy, shipping oil and gas from all over the world. Well, what about all the oil and gas in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan? And all of this is part of the One Belt, One Road. They're also putting in gas lines, they're putting in oil lines, they're putting in road systems, they're putting in high-speed trains, magnetic trains, and this is going to run from China, it'll run to North Korea, it'll run to South Korea, it's going to run, they have also a maritime Silk Road as well. It's going to run across Central Asia, South Asia, to Russia, Eastern Europe, Middle East, Swahili coast into Central Africa. And I'm going to put it in another perspective. In the 1960s, there was the non-aligned movement. You had China and India, you know, Nehru, Zhou Enlai met in Bandung, and it was the third world unite against the West. And all of that stuff kind of fell apart later on because it got radical and it became militant. Algiers, Che Guevara, and it took a different direction. This is bringing back the non-aligned movement, but bringing it back with infrastructure, ecological infrastructure, and finance. So China's driving a lot of this process. It's also doing swap agreements with a lot of countries around, and beginning to use the yen currency, its own currency, as the vehicle for payment, meaning that you don't have to exchange yen through another currency like the U.S. dollar to get to another currency, which is the traditional way of doing things in the Bretton Woods system. It's direct. As they expand the bandwidth of the yen currency without making it convertible in these stages, in the early medium stages, they are expanding the influence of that currency and the use of that currency as a means of payment. In turn, they will then be able to finance or print, do what we do, print money. Part of this strategy is a resilience against conflict with the United States by creating an alternative economic and financial architecture. And there were a series of drivers that pushed China toward this. The first was the Asian financial crisis, in which they fought and supported. There was a split in views. The IMF came into Indonesia and Thailand and said, you have to, you know, decouple, liberalize your currency, privatize your companies, you have to immediately remove all subsidies for staples, and you had political crisis. And China refused to do that, and in fact came in and said, you touch the Hong Kong dollar, we're going to kill you. Hedge funds, come. That was Zhu Rongji. Come, take me on. And stabilize the region. So when the next financial crisis occurred, in 2008, one decade later, there was the Chiang Mai Initiative, and the Asian countries came together and said, let's create our own currency stabilization fund. We don't want the IMF and World Bank. We've had it. And so that was the initiative, followed by, I believe it was July 2012, at the BRICS meeting, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, in Delhi. The Delhi Declaration basically said the quantitative easing policy of the Fed has the potential of creating enormous currency instability in our developing countries, which it did, because we printed money in quantitative easing that never went to infrastructure. It went to banks that then traded it in arbitrage, and it went into, of course, developing markets, emerging markets, and it also went into commodities, derivatives, same thing. But when we started to taper on quantitative easing, you had currencies like Brazil go, you know, haywire. And so the idea of, we now need to have, this came out of the Delhi Declaration, we now need to have our own banks, our own multilateral development banks, of which now there's two, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the New Development Bank, which is the BRICS Development Bank. And these are funded, China, India, Russia in that order, and then other countries. And so these will be the drivers of this new infrastructure, and the ecological civilization policies are being adopted by them in their conditionality for investment. So, you know, what we now see emerging in our planet is potentially, if you ask me to make another prediction, is you're going to have two financial architectures running in parallel. We talked about parallel universes, okay? In parallel, one will be this Asian infrastructure that runs throughout the developing world, and the other will be the old one, which will be North America and Europe. And that's the future as I see it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to all of our panelists. I want to say that the producers will hand you cards if you put your name up. I've got a couple of questions I'll start out with. Here's one producer, and we can bring cards up. Please indicate, if possible, that you're a student or not. We'll try to move the questions for the students up to the front.
Can I make one quick comment?
Yes, please.
And I think this is very important. It's about soft power, which has not been discussed except only in once. I don't know of anybody who wants a passport to live in China, who wants to become a Chinese citizen. I don't know of any foreigner. America remains the aspirational country to the world, and it's very important that that be maintained. I really worry about this. I'm very patriotic about America. I want people to want to become Americans. China has a real tin ear when it comes to soft power. They don't know how to do it. And it's very interesting because the environment is a very sensitive area that has great sex appeal. But it is not an obvious win that the Chinese will do this particularly well, because they haven't done it well in any other areas in the world. So I think when you should all worry, whether you're on the left or the right, is when people are queuing up to get a Chinese passport. What I'm going to worry about is when people stop queuing up to get American passports. I'm done.
Add to that? Because China will not give passports to foreigners.
Yeah, right.
And actually, there's many people who have tried to get Chinese passports. It's extremely impossible. They will not give a Chinese passport to any foreigner.
That doesn't undermine my point.
My other point is they're also very restrictive on even permanent residence. It's extremely difficult to get a long-term visa in China and a work visa. I'm not complimenting this. I personally think the greatest asset that we have as a nation is actually our very liberal policies for immigration, because we do bring in the best and the brightest.
Correct.
And that helps to regenerate our bloodlines. And I think that ideas of restricting immigration because of race, color, or religion are things that will cut that lifeline of tremendous creativity, innovation, and you were quoting again parallel universes and mantra. A big chunk of what, on my philosophical side, is the power of entanglement. That is diversity entangling, because it brings out so much potentiality. So I think China's at a disadvantage for not opening up in this respect. And we have a huge comparative advantage to take advantage of here. And again, why is a monolithic, very, very, one-sided culture? They're learning languages. Their diplomats in the Middle East are speaking Arabic. Their diplomats in, their business leaders in Africa are speaking Swahili. We have all the potential to do this. We should be the leaders on it. We should be taking advantage of all of our diverse power that we have in soft power and leading with all of our connectivity. So,
that's exactly right. I mean, I think it's also, Lawrence has laid out very well the ambitions of the Chinese leadership right now. But we shouldn't underestimate, I know Lawrence doesn't, just how difficult that's going to be for them to pull off. I mean, there's lots of resistance within China to that agenda, whether it's ecology or the environment, reform of SOEs, all the things they have to do, some of which I mentioned. The international ambition is also going to be extremely difficult. They did get the IMF to accept them as an SDR reserve for currency. However, it was more of a political than an economic decision. There's still the yuan is just a very, very tiny percentage of total of use in terms of currency around the world, certainly very, very small share of what the U.S. dollar is. A growing share of RMB in the international currency markets is actually a good thing for the United States, not a bad thing, but it's just very small. It's not growing very fast at this stage. I mean, hopefully it will take off a little bit faster, but it's going to be difficult given that Chinese policies have to change to make that happen. I mean, people aren't going to want to have a currency they can't use freely. You can't use the RMB freely today. And so they're going to have to make it fully convertible, both the current account and the capital account, and they're just not ready to do that yet. And in fact, they've actually gone backwards in the last year on that very issue because of their concerns about capital flight. And then, in terms of, just reiterate what both Peter and Lawrence said, that it's, one of the reasons the U.S. became a leader is because we had an open society and an open economy. I mean, we this is one of the disturbing things about the new administration. I still use administration. But, new administration is their stance on trade, but let's see where they actually go with it. One of the reasons we became a leader is that we had a compared to all the other developed and developing countries, the most open economy in the world. That is actually a strength for us, but that means that we import a lot from the world. People are dependent on us as a market. And that's one of the sources of our leadership is our open economy in addition to being an open society. China doesn't have that. And it's not. And again, they're not even moving in the right direction in that front. They are moving it's not clear where they're moving on the trade front, but this, certainly in terms of industrial policy and in their policies towards the high-tech industry, it does have a very protectionist bent even today. So, they have some difficult... I mean, I wouldn't want to be a Chinese leader. It's a very tough job. I wish them well.
I would also add to this. I've been studying Chinese law policy for the last 25 years or so. And one thing I've learned is that there's a very big gap between aspiration and actual implementation. And one sees this from the very, very beginning of the history of the PRC. Relatively grandiose plans for gender equality, promoting patriotism, promoting women in the workforce, promoting public health. And when you look at documents in Chinese archives, not public statements by officials, which are predictably positive, one sees a very, very large gap between what the government wants, what it says it wants, and what actually happens down at the lowest levels of the administration. Just to give a very small example, in 1953, there was this big campaign called the Marriage Law. And one of the elements of this marriage law was to encourage women to have marriages based on love rather than arranged marriages. But in the provinces, there were some places that got the name wrong, and they thought it was a law that required people to get married. And so you had these meetings when all of the bachelors were kind of rounded up, and all the widows were rounded up, and they were told to marry each other. And the women were very upset by this, and they go running off to the county seat complaining that they were being asked to marry these young guys who had no interest in marrying when they were in their 60s and 70s. I can bring up examples from the treatment of veterans. I can bring up examples from efforts to turn the Chinese population away from pro-U.S. views during the Korean War. So at the height of the Korean War, the government tried to mobilize Chinese public opinion to test the United States. But they interviewed people on the street, and they found out that people were very pro-U.S., because penicillin was invented in the United States. Americans had jazz music. American higher education was very good. American science technology was best in the world. And all these efforts to convince Chinese that we were, the number one arch enemy, rogue imperialists, came to naught. And I can give examples upon examples of this, even during the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s. And so I think relying on plans and aspirations and public statements by the government is a very a partial way of trying to understand what happens down in the bowels of the polity. And if you are interested sort of in any one work encapsulating this problem, including the soft power issue, it's not as if they haven't tried. They have Confucius Institutes all over the United States. But they don't work very well.
No.
They don't do well promoting pro-Chinese views. There's an excellent book by David Shambaugh, teaches at George Washington University, and it's subtitled The Partial Power. And it basically makes this point that China has so many domestic problems, so many challenges from the environment to corruption, to unemployment, that it really can't afford to challenge the United States as a world superpower. If you read any one book coming out of this, I would suggest David Shambaugh. He really knows what he's talking about.
Okay, great. I want to knock out a couple of questions here. I will throw the first easy ones out. I've got knee-jerk reaction questions that...
Why don't you start with the hard ones?
You want to start with the hard ones?
Yeah, don't mess around.
No messing around. There's no time. what about unfair trade practices such as dumping steel? We've spoken about currency manipulation, patent infringements, and tariffs. Anybody would like to take that question?
I touched on it a little bit. I think, again, there are issues, obviously, in the trade front between the U.S. and China. The point I was trying to make in my opening was that in the trade side, we actually have things in interest, common interests. And that is a lot of the dumping that has taken place really is a result of this this industrialization that took place in the late 90s, early 2000s in China, where they just kind of they became the world supplier of aluminum, for example. They went from zero production to being 90% of the world's production overnight, virtually. And so they just kind of sprang on the scene with this, frankly uneconomic investments in certain industries. That has been a problem in terms of a level playing field for other companies around the world, not just the United States, but obviously in Europe as well. That's not a sustainable approach for China, and it can be addressed. I think the danger, though, is that on the anti-dumping side, is that there are a lot of frankly legitimate imports that we're importing from China that are getting targeted for anti-dumping. It's frankly very easy. If you've got a good anti-dumping lawyer in Washington, D.C., to make an anti-dumping case that might be actually not in the interest of American consumers. We saw some of those cases in the Obama administration. My concern is that we're actually going to have a proliferation of anti-dumping actions against Chinese imports, some legitimate, some illegitimate, but a lot of them could win. And as a result, we'll have a deterioration in our trading relationship and, of course, harm to American consumers as we pay higher prices for our purchases, our imports.
Okay, another quick question here. Lawrence Brom mentioned the end of dollar of the U.S. dollar dominance, and do other panelists agree or disagree?
Disagree. That's short and sweet. I think if anybody thinks that the Chinese are going to be at the mercy of the Greek economy, you're nuts. It's still a very controlled economy, and it cannot throw itself on the mercy of world markets in that fashion. So if it happens, it will be very gradual, but the currency has to be continually controlled in different ways at different times for different reasons.
You know, sarcastically, I'm tempted to say, "Welcome to leadership. It's all yours," because there's a cost to leadership. You have to give up control to be a leader, and the U.S. was willing to do that. Hopefully, we'll continue to be, but it's not clear.
Yeah, I would disagree also, mainly because the issue of trust. I'm not entirely sure that most people trust what the Chinese government does and how it makes decisions. It's certainly not very transparent. And I think that if you want to be a global leader in finance, you have to, and expect people to invest in your currency or bonds or whatnot, you have to be more open to the world. You have to let people know how you make decisions. And if you can't do that, you have no real position to demand that level of trust. So I disagree.
Let me respond to it with the technomics of what's taking place. So now there's London is one of the first currency swap centers for the yen currency. And one of the reasons for, London, when they set the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the Obama administration encouraged countries not to join it. I think now about 60 or 70 countries have joined. The first mover on that from Europe was the UK, because they fully realize and understand the power, potential power, of the yen currency. And they're very motivated. I've watched and I've worked with British diplomats over the years in terms of being able to work in the financial sector with China in this evolution. The second swap center is Singapore. There is now going to be a renminbi free trade forex zone, which will be across the border from Hong Kong. And the way they do things is they start with small experiments. And the experiment may be in an isolated area, and then they'll try to expand it if it works. If it has problems in the expansion stage, and they get pushback, they pull back and they rethink it and then they do it again. And that is how the country has gone from a harsh communist regime. When I arrived there in 81, they were still communes, to now being powerful market economy, if not the global economic power. Secondly, is the next stage of this process is direct swap agreements with the bordering countries of China. So these are countries that share borders, so that the yuan currency is used in cross-border trade. So it's a very tricky thing they're trying to do. They're trying to expand the bandwidth of the yuan without going to immediate convertibility. So it's what Peter just said, they will control it. They will definitely control the process. But this process is on, and then it'll be continued in the One Belt, One Road nations, which are now up to 70. And as a country signs an MOU with China, one of the big processes that begins is a direct dialogue between central banks for currency swap. So this is a process which has already begun.
Okay, thank you. I've got like 3 or 4 minutes for a couple of rapid-fire questions. We'll throw this out to the panelists. Okay, first, Spratly Islands, the island conflicts. Do you guys feel that is a big threat or not a problem?
Well, I think that if there's, in this particular scenario, if there's a will, there's a way. I mean, countries have forever agreed how to divvy up resources, even contested resources. But as I said before, I think there's interest in keeping it in low boil crisis mode for quite some time, because it serves multiple parties' interests, including the Philippines, including Taiwan, including the PRC. So again, crisis can be a mode of governance. It helps leaders get things done if they can purposely foment a sense of crisis. It lets them bypass bureaucratic obstacles, create favorable public opinion, and from the outside, it might seem, you know, why are you creating a crisis? But this is how leadership often works. And my sense is that the Spratly Islands is one of those cases that we will see over and over and over again. And it will not get resolved because they don't want it resolved.
But of all things, you have this psycho running the Philippines who's now playing footsies with the Chinese, who are sort of trying to calm things down in this very sensitive area. So these equations are quite unpredictable in how these solutions or tensions might be either helped or hurt.
One more.
I know.
One more last question, maybe a yes or no question. Is the U.S. bankrupt, in fact, due to our trade debt?
No. That's just a complete misreading of what a trade deficit is. So we don't. Trade deficits are, you know, we get goods, we pay our money out, but then the capital comes back to us through investment. So we're not bankrupt. If you're going to worry about a big number, worry about the government debt number. Don't worry about the current account number.
One last question. I was asked how many panelists. How about in this room? How many people speak Mandarin Chinese?
To what level?
Of the panelists. Or of the room and panelists. That's about 8. Japanese? Other Asian languages? Okay, that's interesting. I believe I have 30 seconds left. I have 20 questions, maybe 30 in front of me. Anybody have any others? How about, is democracy with Chinese characteristics possible?
What does that mean?
Democracy within a one-party system.
I think the principle of democracy is multi-party elections when one side can win. So I don't see it happening.
And where the other side can win as well.
One last question we have time for. I'm not being told to leave yet. What about the huge number of high-rise buildings that are being built all around Beijing? I think there was somebody who mentioned they're there. How's that going to work?
A lot of
elevators.
A lot of air conditioning.
Actually, that's an important question because there is a lot of questions about whether they've overbuilt. Actually, my view is that certainly in Beijing, I don't think they have. I mean, there still is a shortage of housing in Beijing. And even in some of the, you know, a lot of these, you see lots of pictures of the deserted condos and stuff like that. And some of those will indeed be, won't work, just like Las Vegas, parts of Las Vegas didn't work. But I think overall, I'm actually less worried about a real estate crisis in China. I think they're going to, given the growing middle class, there's going to continue to be demand for that housing. So I worry less about that than I do worry about oversupply in the industrial sector where you have lots of redundant supply.
And the rural areas are being hollowed out. And these people are moving to, it's not second ring or third ring or fourth ring cities, it's fifth, sixth, seventh. And people are moving out of the countryside. They need to live places.
But the problem might not be in Beijing, because Beijing is surrounded by land. It's Shanghai and Guangzhou, which are sinking because they're built, you know, on land that's not exactly Manhattan. So more weight on this land sinks the land, rising sea levels. So within 30, 40 years, parts of Shanghai could be completely inundated unless they do something about it, and we do something about it. Similarly, in Guangzhou, same problem. Coastal cities are the problem, I think, environmentally.
So. All right, I want to thank all of our panelists. One last